No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Good evening, and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will try to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So please call in to, it's been so long I can't remember the number. Oh my God, Doug will have to give you the call-in number. But please call in and be part of the show, because obviously we need your help. 888-627-6008. Thank you, Doug, for that. And thanks to all our loyal listeners who are back tonight listening to us. We've been off the air now for a while because of what happened in Paradise, California. Many of you know the show comes out of Paradise on the BBS radio platform, and Paradise was destroyed by a fire, and hence we haven't been able to be on the air for more than a month now. So we appreciate it if you come back to listen to us, and the thing I appreciate most is that Maria Sanchez has come back. Hi, Maria. Happy holidays. Michael, it's great to hear your voice.
And to you, Merry Christmas. And to our listeners, again, I just was saying with Doug, who's the proprietor of BBS Radio, and lost everything, not only personally and professionally, in the fire. I know others have, because I was surrounded by a different fire. And somehow words are feel like platitudes. Like it's, I said, I'm sorry. I don't know what else to say. It's terrible. I can't imagine. And as I said, we had the Thomas Fire in December of last year that destroyed, had the most individual destruction until the Paradise Fire, and which was the campfire. And then we had our own fire here in Southern California. I was mandatory evacuated for 4 days, but my home, I came back to a home that was standing. So it's, the losses are insurmountable.
And you know, Maria, that's what I was saying to Doug, actually Don earlier, was that, you know, in my 65 years, I've seen a lot of things, but I never remember seeing a town that was totally destroyed. I mean, the pictures coming out of Paradise were just amazing to me. The destruction was unimaginable. We had a house a few weeks ago across the street from where I live, and unfortunately, two people perished in that fire. But the house
How is that
standing.
Possible in this day and age with smoke detectors and alarms and stuff?
They said there were 5 smoke detectors, Maria, and none of them worked. And one of the victims was an 85-year-old woman, and her 62-year-old son was the other victim. And they had 5 smoke alarms, and none of them were functional. I don't know if they had dead batteries or.
That's what I'm wondering.
But yeah, and the neighbors called it in, and you know, a big old wood frame, kind of farmhouse looking house, and yeah, just went up quickly, I guess. And but you're right. How does that happen in this day and age in a metropolitan area? This house is less than a mile from the fire department. There are probably 3 fire departments within a mile or so of this particular house. So,
well, that's a reminder that you're supposed to change your batteries twice a year when we change our clocks.
Yep.
As a good rule of thumb. And the other thing that I've been learning from people who did lose a lot is that most of us are underinsured. So I had a conversation with my insurance agent this week and said, look at my coverage. Here's the square footage. What are we doing? He was quoting $300 per square foot to rebuild. And I said, but I hear if you have to do it to code. And he said, it depends on, you know, if you were built like, I think post 1980, you're okay, blah, blah. Anyway, I was $200 under insured.
Yeah.
$200,000 under insured. And so he said, your premium's going to go up. I said, yeah, go ahead. I want the right coverage. Because when they've lost it, they haven't been able to rebuild because they don't have the right amount of coverage.
That's right. And you know, that's most people's largest investment in life is their home.
Right.
And Pat and I bought a house 27 years ago, which is now worth approximately three times what we bought it for. So, that's the first thing I'm going to do in the new year, Maria, is check my insurance coverage.
I would do it tomorrow.
Yeah, right. You're right, because I just put up the Christmas tree, and I was the one that put the lights on it. So, you know, we never know what can happen. I'm not, how should I put this? I think I'm a handyman, but I'm not.
Yeah. You know? You've been pretty clear about that with DIY projects.
I've learned, I learned over the years. I think the first serious realization was when I opened the hood of my, 1994 Lexus, and I asked a guy at the gas station where the carburetor was, and he looked at me and said, "What's a carburetor?" So, I guess at that point I realized, maybe I'm not up to speed on my skills. And this is especially true in an old house. I live in a house that was built, and well, you've been here, Maria, in the 1920s, and one size fits all does not apply to this particular dwelling. Nothing is standard about this house. Even the windows are all different sizes. Now, how does that make sense that you've got four windows in your living room and each one of them is a different size?
They must have been put in at different times is my only answer.
When they did the renovation to our house, they did a little addition to our house. The guy said to me, well, they built them on site, you know?
Oh, I see.
So
yeah,
each
individual uniquely yours.
Right. And they're only a couple inches different. When you look at them, you can't tell that they're different sizes.
Uh-huh.
They are. And I have wooden storm windows, and each one of them is numbered so that it goes back to the window it was built for. Yeah.
So Doug put in the number. It's 888-627-6008 if you'd like to join the conversation. Thank you, Doug.
Please join the conversation.
Yeah.
And
talk about what's been going on since we last met?
Yeah, please.
So my semester finished on a week ago today, and I had to take two incompletes because I wasn't able to. We had the borderline massacre shooting here, which was 12 gunmen shot 12, one of which was a law enforcement officer who was 29 years on the sheriff's department and going to be retiring in the next 2 months. And he was shot. The forensic just came out by the other responding officer. It was, as they call it, friendly fire. And, but the gunman ambushed them. He shot the 12 and then he waited for them to respond and he threw grenades and smoke, gas. So that there was mayhem, and then grateful he turned the gun on himself, but not before he shot the officer, the responding. He shot the officer five times, but the sixth bullet and the one that killed him was shot by the CHP officer. So that was Wednesday night. Then Thursday night, my kitchen was finally finished, and Thursday night was the evacuation. So the construction workers left like at 7 o'clock that night, and then later that night was the mandatory evacuation. And then no technology. A cable got cut, so we didn't have any. So I had to text message, fortunately, the woman who runs the media psychology department and say, would you please let my professors know that I'm unable to turn in my assignments because I can't. And also I'm not in my home. So all of that to say, and then I moved, that I couldn't finish out the semester properly. So I'm after Christmas, I'm going to have to finish that up, which I'm not looking forward to because I really wanted a vacation.
I know that feeling. I remember, even though it's been a long time for me since I was in graduate school, I remember that it was easier to take an incomplete in graduate school than it was as an undergraduate, because they understand that you have most people in graduate school have complicated lives, jobs, and other things.
Right.
And I took a couple, and they just went on and on. I remember the agony of, finishing everything and taking comprehensive exams and still having these two incompletes hanging over my head and having to motivate myself to go do it. So, it's hard, but if anybody can do it, it's you, Maria. You're an inspiration to us all, because I have a friend that used to say, those that seek to teach must never cease to learn. And you are certainly a living, walking, talking example of that.
Thank you for that.
It really is an inspiration that you continue your education. I would go back to school, except Mrs. Brown would kill me if I did that. She can barely put up with me now. She doesn't want me to take on anything else. But,
yes, your plate is overfilled. And the thing about graduate school and at the doctoral level is the amount of work is ridiculous, and what the expectations are in terms of what the assignments are. I mean, I had one of my classes that I did finish. My final paper was 20 pages, and that was 50% of my grade. So no pressure there, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To be able to say something, so I understand the dissertation's over 200 pages, so they're getting this ready, I guess, but
I assume the same thing is true of your program, but in my program, you couldn't get anything less than a B.
That's
nothing
correct.
Less than a B counted, only an
That's
A or
correct.
B, and I too was on a PhD program. And I burned out, and I got I was going to take a break, and my sister, who was the most brilliant person I ever knew, said to me, well, how far are you away from a master's degree? And I looked into it, and I was 6 credits away. And she said, well, why don't you get your master's degree? And then if you never go back to finish your PhD, at least you'll have your master's degree. And that's what I did. And it was a brilliant move because I've never gone back.
What great advice, because I get a master's degree in 2 more classes, another one along the way, because they said everything they asked for the PhD leading up to this point, X amount of units and X amount of classes, is what the master's degree in media psychology gets. So you get it too along the way. It's called nested, I think. And I was like, okay, so now I'll have 2 masters and then the PhD.
Yeah, and it was the same with my program. If you took, now you could take master's degree level courses, and I never did. I took PhD level courses, but they qualified as master's degree course. There were like 600 and 700 and 800 level courses, and I only took 700 and 800 level courses. So they qualified, for the master's degree. And yeah, and it was, and I didn't get that until I looked into it. But my sister, knew that and it was the right thing to do because I've never gone back.
Interestingly enough, I'm going to take my first and only master's, class next semester that starts in January. And it's so that I can have a PhD in media psychology with an emphasis in positive psychology. So this one class adds to the requirements for that emphasis part. So I thought I might as well. What the heck? It's one class, because I have all the others anyway. So we'll get the emphasis in positive psychology, which is a whole other field.
I just want to state right now that if you need a dysfunctional person to do your PhD dissertation on, I'm available as a media, as a dysfunctional media person. You're certainly.
Well, we're a part of what I'm studying. Because I'm studying the psychology behind technology and the user experience. And one of the classes that I took last semester, or this one that just ended, was social justice and activism. And that was the 20-page paper. And what we're doing with BBS Radio is also, and what you're doing with your grassroots DC for statehood, is part of what I'm studying. How does that happen? How does social justice happen? How does social activism happen? I.e. my independent study on Dick Gregory. And I've just finished his fourth autobiography, by the way. Well, no, I should say three autobiographies, one biography on him. So I'm quite well versed now on the man, and it's all through technology.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, talking about what happened since last we met, I just learned a lot about the internet. I just learned a lot about Twitter because I saw a tweet that I considered racist, trite, but mildly racist. And I responded to it, not understanding that the person that I responded to had almost 750,000 Twitter followers. And for 2.5 days, I was bombarded with tweets from people.
So how many followers you cut out there?
Oh, he has 601,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what happened? What went down with the tweets and the retweets and everything and the shares?
Well, what happened was people attacked me for the comments I made about the tweet. Now I realized after I got hundreds of these that what they were really doing was they were attacking me for having the audacity to say something negative to somebody they liked.
Mm-hmm.
And really I feel a little silly about that because I should know that as a politician, that it's really sometimes not so much what you say, but who you say it to. And I made a comment about this guy. He's a brilliant reporter, not even 30 years old, and he's won a Pulitzer Prize. So he's a brilliant reporter, and people like him. And I made a comment. He said something that I thought was racist, and I commented on it about somebody I know, and I commented about it, and people were like, you know, mostly lighten up, get a sense of humor, blah 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 blah, you know, you suck, you know, I mean, they really came at me, and I said to myself, wow, and the thing that amazed me about it, I think, is that they really didn't much comment on what I said. I got some comments on what I said, but most of the comments were more that I shouldn't say anything, you know, that I should have, you know, that somehow I disrespected this person. And they really didn't comment on the comment. They commented on me. And I found that very, very interesting. There were people that also sided with me, of course, but I've got to tell you, 10 times as many people didn't side with me as did side with me. And, somebody said to me though, in the end, to put it in perspective, well, if you got 300 bad tweets from people and he has 601,000 followers, then 99.5% followers agreed with you, didn't care, didn't read it, didn't, you know what I mean? You really heard, it seems like a lot of people, but you really heard from a really, really tiny portion of the people that followed him. And that's true. But yeah, I was surprised. I was stunned. I kept on coming by politicians sit and say, what are you, crazy? Starting a fight with somebody that has 600,000 followers?
Except for, hopefully, you raised some of their perspectives or views because you brought it to the forefront. I mean, I understand the loyalty thing because people follow people who are like-minded in general. You don't follow somebody that you don't like, right? So that I understand them defending, but maybe you created a conversation that they needed to have and they hadn't had.
Well, that's another funny externality, I guess, is that I got 25 new followers from it. You know, I mean, so yeah, to a certain extent I did. But it was an interesting lesson, and it's interesting how this really works and how lightning quick, issues can get out there, discussed, hashed, rehashed. You know, it's amazing. I mean, on one level, I've known this, of course, because I stay in touch with what's going on, but then to experience it personally is a little different. You know, it's a little, brings it home a little more. And also some of the things that are said, out there, you know, I have more than 10,000 people that follow me on social media between several different platforms. And in the time that I've had those people, which goes back, I've been on the internet 9 years on different platforms, I blocked one person who was a bully. And the things that this guy has been able to say about me, I'm just amazed at it. I'm just amazed that you can go out there and say anything you want about anybody.
Yeah.
And pick things up, and which he has. He's made things up. You know, and it just amazes me. And I've had people criticize me and tell me that the court has ruled that elected officials can't block people. But the court has not ruled that. The court has ruled that you can't block somebody with a different opinion. You can block people that swear at you on the internet and call you names and try to degrade you. And that's what I've done with one person. But I've got people writing me saying, how can you block an activist? Well,
if they're, to me, and my whole talk radio career as a host, I said, I don't care if you agree with me, but you need to be intelligent and you need to be courteous in your disagreement. And when people get personal or nasty, I consider that hostile. And so, yeah, block them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Especially
when they don't know you.
Well, you know, especially when they're a bully.
The best thing with this guy is that we offered to have a meeting with him. And he said, okay. So we set up a meeting, and me and my staff waited for an hour, and he never showed up, and he never called to cancel, and he never, you know, because he's a bully. He wants to hide on the internet and do these things anonymously. And, you know, I'm not only from North New Jersey, but I've been in politics for 40 years. So, you know, this rolls off my back to a certain extent, but I can see why teenage kids, you know, why this affects them so dramatically while they're trying to develop a sense of identity and find out where they fit in the world. If they get attacked like this, I can see why it's so horrible and why some of them even take their lives over it. It's just, and I don't know what we do about that, but.
Well, what I did this year was in one of my classes was create a curriculum called digital literacy. And that before you're allowed on what we know as the World Wide Web, you have to take this course, which is a primer. And it goes through what it is that's considered okay, what's not okay, et cetera. And then you're allowed onto the www. And we have to do that with almost everything else in life, except for being a parent. We don't have to take a course on that competency, because we are the Wild Wild West still. That's what the www stands for. because there isn't. Now, Europe, the EU just introduced legislation in May of this year called GDPR, and that stands for something, but it said that you have to opt in to things, for example, instead of our system is you have to opt out. So, and that you have to sign an agreement that you understand that. And then the websites have to say who is, taking the information, what information are they taking, et cetera. And then you agree to that. Whereas here, we don't know who's aggregating our, you know, even the Fitbits, the trackables, all that information that the proprietor of the device gets from you is available to them. Because by you wearing it, you're agreeing to their terms and conditions, and then they can aggregate that and sell it to somebody. And we don't know to whom or what, but over there, they made this all plain and simple, and we're not even in a conversation about it here in the United States.
Right. And it surprises me that people don't realize that. You know, I certainly always realized it because I was in the business of working with people like that for many, many years because I was a direct mail consultant. But of course, in direct mail, where they sell information, they have groups that sell information. The information isn't the kind of information you can get today. I mean, people sell your name, address, phone number, maybe your occupation. They use certain computer programs, to figure out what your sex was. They use geographic programs to try to figure out what your income level was, things like that, but they were estimated. But now, oh my God, they know so much, about the intimate details of your life, and you really have to be careful about that stuff. And aren't we seeing that? Now we're moving in the right direction here because I want to talk about some current events. But aren't we seeing that with Facebook and some of these other platforms which are putting your information out there?
Well, the Cambridge Analytica is the thing that I think opened people's eyes. But in my big data class, I gave an example of if you are on the internet and you are looking to purchase a deep fat fryer as a gift, or you want to know what brands are available or what they cost, an insurance company can be given that information and make the decision that you're an unhealthy individual because you're looking to purchase a deep fat fryer. And then they can charge you different rates for your health insurance policy because they've deemed you to have unhealthy habits.
That's incredible.
And that's happening to this day. So you really need to be cautious where you click.
Well, you know,
I don't mean you, Michael. I mean us. We.
No, I get
every
it.
Every click. Is somebody's making a conclusion about you.
I've had the flu for, I'm just getting over it now, but I've done a lot of Christmas shopping on the net this year, and that's it. You know, I'll click on, let's say I'm interested in buying a bike for one of my kids. I'll click on bicycles and I'll look at a couple of bicycles. And the next day when I turn on my computer, as it comes up, there'll be a list of bikes on the right-hand side of my computer.
Mm-hmm. And I've done that with my traveling when I was going to the conferences and I was looking at hotels in different cities or what to do while in that city. Then the next day, here's some items. I was in D.C. in October with you, and I still get looking for D.C. hotel deals, looking for D.C., you know, things to do. And it's like, yeah, they know, and we willingly give that up by clicking. When I went to Harvard for that conference, I forget when that was. I think that was in October also. I posted on Facebook that I was headed to the hallowed grounds of Harvard University, having never been there before. And some people commented in my feed. And then one gal said, wow, that didn't take long. I'm already getting Harvard paraphernalia in my Facebook feed to purchase because she had commented about Harvard in mine.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible how quickly this works. And if you think back, for those of us that are older, the internet is still in its infancy.
Yes.
You know, imagine 20 years from now. Every year it gets more and more intense. And, you know, it's funny that you should bring up Cambridge Analytical. Analytica, because when I went to Portugal, I met a guy from Oxford Analytica, one of the principals of Oxford Analytica, and his son was my intern over the summer, just a great young man from Georgia Tech named Teddy. And so when I hired Teddy, I went on to look at the Oxford Analytica webpage. And this was right after the Cambridge Analytica thing. And that's the first thing the webpage said. We are not Cambridge Analytica. They wanted to make that very, they wanted to make that very clear.
Which so, has since gone out of business.
Yeah, I know. I mean.
So yeah, it does show you. So what you and I are talking about with the clicks is called our digital footprint. Uh-huh. That is how they make, assumptions about us. But then, the digital footprint, as we go down the cyberspace, gets a digital shadow because other things start penetrating. And suddenly this shadow that we have created through no intentions of our own, just through associations, is something that needs to be analyzed and looked into too, because I haven't done it yet, but that's not directly related. It's associated. And that's even scarier to me. Because the footprint is our clicks.
And as you point out with your story about the deep fryer, mm-hmm. you know, as a marketer, and I ran a marketing company for 25 years, you're looking for aggregates. You're making assumptions, understanding that you're not going to be right. Understanding it's all a percentage game. For example, we might use a mailing list, back in the day. We might have used a mailing list, from, Sports Illustrated, because we found out that, 75% of the people that read Sports Illustrated were Democrats. Well, that means that 25% of them weren't, but we treated them as if they were.
Mm-hmm.
Because we knew we could never reach 100%. We were just looking for a majority, mm-hmm. you know, to send our mail. We knew when we sent them out that 25% of the people would throw them out, you know, without opening because they were from another party. But that didn't matter. We did it anyway. And it seems to me that that could have really serious implications when you're talking about things like, you know, and insurance premiums and things like that, assuming that the deep fryer, because you know what? If Mrs. Brown bought the deep fryer, Mrs. Brown goes 4 days a week, she would have been buying the deep fryer to give it to me as a gift.
It would have right.
been, you know what I mean? She yes. would have used it. It would have been, yes. it would have been for me. But,
yes. And they said what happens, that was the example that they brought up too. What happens if it was a gift that it wasn't even intended for your household, but for your grandmother or something, right. you know? So, but right. that, like you just gave eloquently, it's the law of averages. So most people who buy deep fat fryers probably aren't as healthy as somebody who doesn't buy a deep fat fryer. So we're just going to make some assumptions here. And you're right. That's what they do.
We're going to lump everybody together. Even if you bought the deep fat fryer so that you can have french fries once a month, you know,
exactly.
and not, right, you know,
yes.
Yeah, so we all have to be careful about that. And, you know,
and I don't think people realize that is the, like you said, it's hard to believe that people don't know that. But I mean, the more I'm learning, the more I'm discovering there's more that we don't know than we do know.
Right. And, you know, we never can forget that the purpose of business is to make money. That's what motivates them. So, you know, you always have to keep that in mind. I love people that say we need to run the government like a business, because the government can't be run like a business. If it's run like it, if we could, we wouldn't need government. Government has a different set of priorities. Now, what the people generally mean is they wish that government could be as efficient as business is. But you can't use the same tools in government that you use in business. You can use some of them, but not all of them. And primarily because the priorities are different. So, you know, we always have to keep that in mind, that the buyer has to beware, because that the people that, that are selling you to you, that's what they care about. They care about selling things to you.
So that you bring up an interesting point then for our listeners, because you were an entrepreneur and you were a businessman. Well, I know you still do, but then you enter the arena of politics, which doesn't make business sense. So how did you reconcile that personally?
Well, you know, it can be very frustrating, right?
I would think so.
Because the bottom line in business is so much clearer. You know, hey, Maria, I can figure out a way for you to save $5,000 a year in your business. You go, great. Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I come to you and you're the governor and I say, gee, Maria, if you cut out using union labor, you can save $5,000 a year. You go, wait a minute. I need those people to vote for me. It's mm-hmm. not a matter of saving money. It's right. So there's a whole different set of priorities that have to be considered. And sometimes it's very, very frustrating. I'll give you a great example. One time I mostly did communications work almost exclusively, actually, for Democrats. We had a situation where they were doing a big retreat for the president. And as part of the retreat, at the last minute, they needed signs, and they didn't need 10 signs. They needed 2,500 signs, and they needed them in a day and a half. They told me like Wednesday afternoon, we need these signs, the thing on Friday. So we found a local vendor that we could do the signs with, where we actually drove out to the vendor, and set everything up. But they had to have a union label, and there were no union sign printers in Washington DC. So we found a place that did, neon signs, and they were members of the International Electrical Workers Union, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW. So they put all their bugs on the paper sign. And that was the joke all weekend, where people would come up to me and go, where are we supposed to plug this in? You know, they were electrical workers. But we finally came to the conclusion that anybody's bug was better than nobody, you know. We couldn't find a sign maker's bug, so we put on an electrical worker's bug. But, you know, we used to run into complications like that all the time. And I was actually, just to give you another, incident, I was in a union one day, and, they were putting down union made carpet in the, you know, lobby of this building that the union owned, and it was the lobby area was 8 or 10,000 square feet, which is a gigantic building. And the head of the union, a man named William Wimbitzinger, came in and found out that even though all the carpet was union made, it was being put down by guys that weren't union. So he had them tear it all up and throw it out. Yeah.
Really?
And you used to run into these things, and, you know, and you would say to yourself, gee, maybe we should have thought of that, or, you know, luckily I was not the vendor in that case, but yeah, there were, I walked in just as these guys were complaining and tearing up the carpet, and people were saying, what are you doing? And they said, they told us to throw it all out and start over again.
Wow. And how do you budget for that?
Yeah. How do you budget for that? You know, so the trade-offs are very much different. And, you know, it's things, and it's frustrating when you're in politics that people, don't understand that. They'll say things like, They want a balanced budget amendment that says that you cannot spend money that you do not have. And that makes sense to people. People stand up and they say, well, I don't spend money that I don't have, so the government shouldn't spend money it doesn't have. But then you have to say to them, look, what if you were out of money for the month and your kid got hit by a car? You wouldn't take him to the emergency room because you couldn't afford to pay the bill? You'd say, sorry, son, we don't have any more money for that. And that's the kind of thing that government has to put up with every day. You can't close down all the hospitals because you don't have the money to keep them open. You have to keep them open and you have to run them in the red or run or finance them or whatever you have to do. And we're seeing that right now. We've closed down the government. And it's going to be closed down. Now we know it's going to be closed down through Christmas. And this is a very tough political hardship here in Washington for very, very many people, not people like me or people that are at the top of government or people that have savings. They'll get their money when the government reopens. But for rank and file workers, yeah, it's a real, real hardship. And these are the kind of choices
you made. Let our listeners know about that trickle down effect. Are you talking about, people that are affiliated with the people who work in the government? Or are you talking about, like, say, Karen, your associate?
Well, no, people that are affiliated, certainly because service the government people. So the guys that have the lunch counters across the street from the Capitol and those kind of people. Yes, absolutely. But also the security people and the, again, the non-unionized, now the Capitol Police, they probably get paid somehow or will get paid because they're union. But, regular security people, ushers, people that, run the Xerox room and the mail room. And, you know, you're talking about 800,000 people. You're not talking, you know, we're not talking about a handful of people. So, yeah, they get hurt in this. And in fact, Karen would have been one of those people because the District of Columbia is, you know, treated as a wholly owned subsidiary of the federal government, except in this particular Congress, our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, was able to get legislation, passed that exempts us from closing down when the federal government closes down. But up until now, every time the federal government closed down, we would close down. So all the D.C. employees would have been affected, too. But because of new legislation, they're no longer. Last time this happened, it was 2 weeks before the Cherry Blossom Parade, and they were going to shut down the Cherry Blossom Parade. And all the people that were associated with it to work on it all year long, and the kids and people from the marching bands all over the country that come and all that stuff. And luckily, just before the day before they made the decision to scrap the parade, Congress came, you know, opened the federal government again, so they didn't have to do it. But yeah, all sorts of things had closed down. All the national parks are closed. You can't go to a national park right now.
The monuments.
So all the monuments are closed. You know.
And the Mint and the.
Yeah.
And what about, like, the Smithsonian's?
Closed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And so all it must be quiet in the District of Columbia. It must be quiet, huh?
Yeah, well, it's quiet. You know, it's quiet this time of year anyway.
Anyway.
Leave because we have a very high transient population. Well, you know, we have more than a dozen universities. We have, you know, military personnel from all over the country. We have, so a lot of people go home at this time of year, and Washington is their temporary home. It's not their permanent home.
Right.
So it's a quiet time of year. But let me tell you, we've had family come at this time of year, and we'll take them like the day after Christmas down to the Smithsonian, mm-hmm. and it's packed. You can't get near the place because, you know, there are so many tourists that also come to Washington this time of year, her family members that come to Washington, and that's where you take them, right? The day after Christmas, you don't want to go to a shopping mall. You want to take them to, you want to take them down to the Air and Space Museum. But all that stuff's closed now.
Goodness. I didn't realize that. And you said 800,000 people?
800,000. Yeah.
That's staggering.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that, you know, sometimes, comes to haunt us, that we have so many government workers because, you know, it is a real advantage here in the District of Columbia. When the country's going through terribly hard times, we have a buffer here. We have the federal government, you know, so our economy is never quite as bad as other economies. Although these days, Maria, have you looked at the stock market lately?
I was just going to say that next. I it scares me. What a way to end a year.
Yeah, what a way to end a year.
Well, and the rate hike, you know, I have an adjustable, and it went up October 1st, and it's gone up again.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, yeah, but it was so low for so long, I feel like, okay, well, there was a time where the payment was really nice and affordable. Now it's becoming less so, but I know that's bothering people too. Well, in the Syria pullout too.
Yeah. And, you know, I had one of my kids one day, we went to the mall. This was a couple of Christmases ago, and they said to me, I can't understand. We went to pick up one little thing and we couldn't even find a parking space, you know. And she said to me, I can't understand why everybody just waits for the last minute. And I said, well, I can tell you they wait for the last paycheck because that's the way I was, right? I grew up that way. I've been an orphan since I was 15 years old. And I always waited for the last paycheck so that I could have the money to do it. I never had, you know what I mean? It wasn't that I was lazy. It wasn't that I didn't realize Christmas was coming. It was that I needed that last paycheck and the $150 Christmas bonus I got in it. And, you know, those things. So, yeah, this really affects people's lives. And, you know, since you and I have, last been together, Marie, I went to Chicago and presented in front of the National Conference of Social Studies Teachers. And we'll have to talk about that in an upcoming show because it was very interesting. 4,200 social studies teachers from around the country. So it was very interesting couple of days for me and Karen. And also, I went to an event where I ran into a senator from Virginia, a state senator, and we started talking about who the next Democratic candidate for president is going to be. And I'd like to have her on the show to talk about that because I'm really interested in who we're going to find. I think that when people talk about the president being out of touch, I think, unfortunately, the Democrats are still out of touch. And I hope that we can change that as a Democrat. You know, today I read in the newspaper, Maria, and I know that you're a parent, so I really want your feedback on this. There was an article in the Washington Post that during the Me Too, because of the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. maybe you shouldn't let your children sit on Santa Claus's lap.
Oh boy.
Right?
You're right there. You're in the breathing space of Santa. But have you heard the little controversy about the song "Baby, It's Cold Outside"?
Oh, yes. Maybe. Yes. Oh my God.
And you know, now when I listen to the lyrics, I think there's a little something to that. He's like cajoling her, and you know, and come on, it's cold outside, and have another drink, and you know, and she's like, well, what do people think? And my parents, and blah, blah, blah. But then there's a Disney movie.
Didn't we used to call that flirting?
Yeah. But the Disney movie, one of the characters sings, go on and kiss the girl. La, 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 la. go on and kiss the girl. And it's like he's saying, just kiss her, you know. So I think we can overreact, but I do think that some of what we took for granted as good natured, maybe it wasn't so good natured. I don't want to sound like a prick.
But I would say the same thing about this article where they said, you know, that parents would take their kids screaming to the, and make them sit on Santa's lap because it was a cute photo op, you know, and yeah, okay, I can see that. We had one kid that didn't want to be near Santa, didn't like him, didn't, scared the hell out of her, and we never pushed her to do it. You know, we'd say, you sure, honey? And she'd go, no, I don't want to. And we go, okay. So there is some truth to that, too. I don't know that you need to traumatize your child.
I agree with you. You know, as much as I would have wanted that, if one of my children reacted like that, I would say, okay, this is not something they want to do. You know, I wasn't a parent who let the tantrums dictate what they did and didn't do. But right. Clearly, if they're deathly afraid, what's the right. game here? That's, right. you know, you've got a picture of a sniveling child. You know, I mean, right. what's the point? Yeah, I wouldn't force that. And obviously, if you're standing right there, nothing's going to happen. They're still under your watch and your care, custody, and control. It's right. when you, you know, delegate that or in another room or you drop them off or what have you. That's when the trouble can start.
But, you know, I think that's one of our problems as Democrats too. And I hope we can talk about that. We're running out of time here. So we'll have to leave it for another show. But, you know, that we talk down to America and that we have to start realizing how in outside New York.
Yeah,
Michael, LA, and,
I didn't hear anything.
I'm sorry, you can't hear me?
You cut out there. You said one of our problems is that we talk down to America?
Yeah, as Democrats, as liberal Democrats, we talk down to America, and we've got to stop doing that. So hopefully we can talk about that in a future show, but we're running out of time, and we've got to say... I've got to say Merry Christmas to people, and I know that's your holiday too, Maria. So I want to wish all our listeners a very Merry Christmas. I hope that this holiday season is full of friends and families and loved ones. Karen criticized me for saying friends and loved ones because she said, what does that mean? Your friends are not your loved ones? But you know what I mean. I hope that this is a time for reflection and a time to be together with your family and a time to say thank you. So thank you, Maria Sanchez, for making my show, our show, so much better than it's ever been with your professional attitude and your brilliance. I really appreciate it. I wouldn't want to do this show with anybody else. So,
it's an honor. To be with you every week, Michael, because I so admire what you do and are doing for the District of Columbia. And do you have a swearing in next month?
Yes, I do. January 2nd. And Mrs. Brown has agreed to hold the Bible.
Oh, and your term is for 6 years?
6 years, yes.
Okay. So congratulations again. But you said January 2nd?
January 2nd, and I'll be in front of about 1,500 people who come because we all get sworn in at the same time. I get to give a speech and yeah, I'll let you know how it goes.
Yes, please. And, if not 1,500 people aren't being sworn in, but there's those that are swear in and their loved ones.
Right. And also 175 to get sworn in because we have neighborhood commissioners and we swear them in groups. There's 8 wards in the city. So all the ANC commissioners from Ward 1 get sworn in together and Ward 2 and Ward 3 and so on and so forth. So there are a lot.
And the wards are based on geography?
Yeah. They're neighborhoods, basically.
Okay. Okay. Well, good.
So,
Congratulations.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
And happy holidays. And thank you for being
happy
with
holidays.
Us. Yeah.
And we're going to play you out with a song by Stevie Wonder. And this is my, every year, my Christmas wish for everybody. So we'll see you in the new year. On behalf of my gracious co-host, Maria Sanchez, and myself, we wish you all the best. Thank you.
And we do. Yes, thank you.
Someday at Christmas, men won't be boys, playing with bombs like kids play with toys. One warm December, our hearts will see a world where men are free. Someday at Christmas.
In the capital of this nation, 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.